Welcome to the monthly Zoom meeting of the Alliance for Constitutional Sex Offense Laws. My name is Janice Bellucci. I am the founding member and the executive director of the Alliance. I'm also an attorney here in California. So we have these meetings every month. Today's date is October 18th, and next month's meeting date is November 15th. So again, today's October 18th of 2025, and our next monthly meeting will be on November 15th, 2025. I know there's at least a few people today who are first timers joining this organization and this Zoom meeting for the first time. Welcome to you all. We're happy to see you here. And I want to explain the reason that we do this. It's a labor of love for sure. And the fact is, we're here to share information with you, but we're also here to give you hope and provide you with support. So that's why we do these monthly meetings. We have three pillars of the organization. One of them is education. The other two are legislation and litigation. And when we have these monthly Zoom meetings, that's part of the education branch. So we know that it's really important for us to exchange information with each other. And so this is really meant to be a two-way dialogue. So if indeed, you know, you have something that you would like us to talk about today, please put it in chat if you would. And the one we'll see will hopefully get to it. We have a lot of things to talk about today. And actually the format of this month's meeting is going to be a little different than usual because we have some guest speakers. And so we'll be introducing them soon. But before we do that, Marty, who is not a guest speaker because he's here every month, is here to talk to you about the emotional support group meetings that we have. Marty.
Thank you, Janice. Hey, good morning, everybody. We all know the traumatic effects of the registry on ourselves and on our loved ones. Bullying, isolation, loneliness, loss of family and friends, difficulty securing work and housing. Life can be difficult for everyone affected. That's why Axol runs emotional support group meetings every week. Our next meetings will be on this Thursday and 1 week from today. And yes, not just for registrants, our loved ones and supporters are more than welcome to attend too. Every Thursday evening, Axol board member Sherry Moreno. Hi, Sherry. Runs the group beginning at 6:30 Pacific time, 9:30 Eastern. The second and fourth Saturday of each month, licensed therapist and Axol board member Alex Gittinger leads the Saturday afternoon Zoom meetings. The time, 3:00 Pacific, 6:00 Eastern. At every meeting, we have a friendly community supporting each other. There's no cost, and we vet every participant so we don't have trolls, bullies, law enforcement, or any haters. How can you get access to participate in these wonderful support groups? Please see the information that I will post in the chat moments after I finish this announcement. I did so a few moments ago, but for people coming in now, you might not get it, so I will go ahead and post one more time in a moment. If you don't have the opportunity to copy this information, you can always click on the emotional support group link on the Axol website homepage. And I promise, after participating in the Axol emotional support groups, you will feel a lot better about yourself. And I'd just like to add, I'd rather be a registrant at an Axol emotional support group meeting with caring friends than a passenger on any Venezuelan boat traveling north right now. Back to you, Janice.
Thank you, Marty. And folks, if you look in the chat part of the website right now, there is, in fact, lots of information there about emotional support group meetings. So you can copy it if you want. You can take a picture of it. Oh, here comes a second time. But I've just, over the years, have seen people, results of people who support or who participate in emotional support group meetings and what a significant difference it's made in their lives. So remember what I said earlier, it's just like, why do we have these monthly Zoom meetings? It's for the same reason. We're here to educate, but we're also here to support you. And this is certainly one form of support. So the meetings that we have now on these Zoom meetings, we're really talking about the law. We're talking about legal issues. We're going to be talking in a minute. Actually, Sherry will be talking in a minute about employment issues. Okay, so let's go ahead and get the meeting started. And the first issue I want to talk about is Halloween, because guess what? Halloween is only a few weeks away. So we filed a major lawsuit in the state of Missouri. It's one of the few lawsuits we have filed so far outside of California. And this is like the case that will never end. At least it seems that way. So in fact, we won at the trial court level, and this is in federal district court. And the judge agreed with us that the requirement to put a sign on your home on Halloween was indeed compelled speech and therefore in violation of the First Amendment. He also, the same trial court judge, issued a statewide permanent injunction. So at this point in time, the state of Missouri cannot enforce their that law that basically said you have to put a sign on the front door, or sorry, not on the front door, but on your home somewhere. And yet, as one city in the state of Missouri about 2 weeks ago sent a letter out to all the people on the registry in their city telling them that they had to put a sign on their door on Halloween. So fortunately, somebody called me up and told me about that, and I basically addressed it right away by going to the law firm that represented that city, and they basically issued a second letter saying, oops, you know, please ignore our first letter. Here's a second letter. And you don't have to put a sign on the front door or on your home. And I'm stumbling here because there was some debate about where the sign had to be, how big the sign had to be, etc. But anyway, in Missouri, at this point in time, you do not have to put a sign on your home on Halloween. And by the way, the city of Hazelwood, which is the city that sent this letter out to their registrants, they were a defendant in the case. So they knew precisely what they should and shouldn't do, and yet they sent this letter out. And trust me, Axel got a lot of many contacts, people by phone, by email, etc. People asking us what this meant, and you know, did they have to do this? So where we are right now, just to let you know, as I said, the district court issued a permanent statewide injunction, and that meant, and that's in place. And so even though I went to St. Louis, Missouri, and argued before the Eighth Circuit Court of Appeals on September 16th, just about a month ago, the fact is that that court, the Eighth Circuit, has not issued their decision yet. And so until and unless the Eighth Circuit basically reverses the statewide permanent injunction, it stays in place. So I hope nobody has any questions about that. By the way, our organization wasn't the only organization who got questions about that. Believe it or not, the Florida Action Committee also got many questions from people living in Missouri. So before we go on, does anybody, and thank you, Roger. Roger in the chat room, by the way, put a link to an article about what I just said about the city of Hazelwood and what they did. Both the first letter they sent out, that was dated October 1st, and then the second letter that they sent out, which was dated October 8th. So I hope everybody in Missouri knows, every registrant knows, that they do not have to put a sign on their home on Halloween. And by the way, we got rid of Halloween sign requirements here in California several years ago. We also sued a county in the state of Arkansas that had a ridiculous sign requirement. So if you know of a Halloween sign requirement in another state, please let us know, because we, in fact, are interested in challenging them. Okay, welcome, Ellie. Ellie just joined us. Welcome. So, John B., you say you have a question?
Morning.
John, do you want to ask your question? Maybe you're having trouble unmuting yourself, John? If so, maybe you could type in the question that you have there in chat. Okay, well, after John asks his question in chat, then I'll do my best to address it. By the way, I just want you all to know that we have several board members here today from the AXOL organization, as well as the foundation. So Roger, Ellie, and Sherry, and myself, we're all board members of AXOL. And then Rick Chu is, in fact, a member of our foundation board of directors. So welcome, all you board members. Thank you for being here today. So Sherry, I think this is the time, if you would be so kind, as to talk about employment issues.
Thank you. Good morning, everyone. As Jenna said, I'm one of the board members. I've been with AXOL, I think, 12 years now. I came because my now ex-husband was going through the legal process, and I was angry as hell and decided to use that anger for good and helping to push for reform. Since that time, I have did a career change and started to working with people coming out of incarceration. So I have a lot of experience working with people coming out of incarceration who have a felony record, as well as helping those who are required to register to finding employment. So I'm going to give you, in regards to my experience here in California, each state is going to be a little bit different. I apologize, I don't know the laws in every state, so I will talk about here in California, but take some of the information that I'm presenting today to kind of help for those who are searching for employment in your own state. Now, in the state of California, people are not required to the state of California does not post a person's employer on the registry. However, there are other states that do. So for those of you who live in a state where they do post an employer and you're needing to look for possible employers that will be willing to hire you, I do recommend to use the registry if you're allowed. Utilize that option as a tool for you in order to help you find employers. For those of you who, like in California, employers are not listed on the registry, there are some other tools that you can use. There is a job search that you can use. It's called Honest Jobs. You're able to put in the type of conviction that you have been convicted of and when you were convicted of it, and it will show you jobs of companies that are willing to hire somebody based on your conviction. So it will kind of lead you to the employer's website where you can go ahead and apply for the position, but it's a tool that you can use nonetheless to help you find employers in your area. The other option is Indeed. If a lot of you have used Indeed in the past, I personally love it simply because not only you have a larger array of employers, but you also have the ability of uploading your resume and clicking to apply instant. But Indeed does have a filter option that when you click on it, when you click on the encourage to apply filter, if you click on fair chance, it will allow you to be able to look for employers that are felon friendly in order for you to narrow your search. And I've used the air quotes felon friendly because, again, every state is different. What employers are willing to hire based on what conviction varies from state to state, but it does kind of help to narrow down your job search. Instead of looking at 200 jobs, you may only be looking at 10. So it really does help with your intentionality in looking and applying for jobs. Sorry, give me a second. When you do have an employer that you are interviewing with, and a lot of states don't require you to don't ask if you have a background, or you have to wait until after an offer has been given to you before that has to be pronounced. But if that is a case, either way, when a question comes up with regards to a background, whether it's during the interview process or after a job offer has been done, I would recommend when you're talking to an employer, when a question comes about, you can answer the question in a way that you are talking about what was going on in your life at the time of the conviction. So you're kind of doing a storytelling. Some people will feel free to talk about what the conviction was. Others decide not to tell what their conviction is. I am going to leave that to your best judgment. However, when I do talk to people, I always encourage them not to disclose what the conviction is, because I don't want to have that ick factor when you're talking to a prospective employee. So what I would do is I would recommend, it says, there was a time when, what was going on in your life? Were you dealing with depression, anxiety? Were you dealing with an addiction? And that addiction can be a variety of different things, drugs, alcohol, internet, you know, addiction. There's a variety of different things that you could do. You don't have to dive in too deep in regards to what that was, but you just want to let them know you were in a dark place at that specific time in your life. You were dealing with former trauma, and you weren't knowing how to deal with it. As a result of this information, it led you to making some poor choice. Notice that I'm not saying bad or anything like that, but you're just acknowledging that you made some choices that led you down a path that, you know, leads you to where you were at today. What happened as a result of those consequences? Did you lose employment? Did you lose connections with family and friends? Did you go to jail or prison for a period of time? Just kind of list of what are some of the different things that you, maybe even talking about some of the effects that it had on your family or society as a whole. Maybe talk about some of that a little bit. What we're doing is we're showing some accountability, you know, that, hey, because of that, these are the consequences that I have endured as a result of those poor consequences. poor choices. Whenever you are talking about stuff like that, I always want you to balance all the negatives with additional positives. So the more positives you want to highlight, it helps to overcome it. They say that it takes two positives to overcome a negative. So the next aspect you want to talk about is, what are some of the things that you have done since that conviction that you've done to work on yourself? So talk about, I understand a lot of, if you have been convicted, you're having to do mandatory sex offense treatment programs. Even though that they're a requirement, it's something that, sorry, just a second. It is still something you could talk about. You went through some type of treat. You want to talk about, what are some other things that you've done? Did you get an education? Did you work on trying to reestablish your relationship? Whatever positives you can think of, did you find or get reconnected with your faith? Whatever you can talk about. It's kind of like when you're in prison, you're going before the parole board. You want to talk about all the positive things that you did while you were in prison. Kind of the same thing. You want to talk about some of those positive aspects of why, what you've been working on yourself in order to prevent you from making the same mistakes in the future. And then focus on where you want to go from now. So my goal is in the future. I want to find full-time employment. I want to get, I'm looking for additional career opportunities. I'm looking for, whatever the future holds for you. You want to share some of that information. So that way you end that conversation in a very positive and uplifting, and you're not thinking about the last thing that you said in regards to your conviction. And when you do this, it really does help with talking to an employer and trying to keep that door open and giving them that opportunity and see you for more than what your conviction is. It lets them see you and humanizes you a little bit more, and it keeps that door open for that opportunity. So there are also, you can always Google felon-friendly jobs. There are several different lists that are out there in regards to employers that are willing to hire people who have a felony record. That's something you can also use as a tool when you're doing your job searches. Usually, typically, those who have been convicted of any type of felony, places that are blue collar jobs, so thinking about warehouse, construction trades, you're talking about, maybe even being like a driver, like a CDL truck driver. Those are some of the ones that are more willing to hire those who have a felony record. Here in the state of California, the state of California is also willing to hire those who have a felony conviction because they know that they are marginalized community. And as long as the conviction has nothing to do with the job that you are applying for, they won't have a problem with hiring you. The same for most states. I have heard those that are in more conservative areas that it's harder to get in. But just as a general rule, the state and county jobs are felon friendly. So that's pretty much what I just wanted to kind of go over and just share some tools. You can always kind of reach out to me as well at SOS group for you. If Roger, if you could put my email in there, if you just want to kind of check in with me and ask me, I'm more than happy to answer any questions and help you get some guidance and tricks. But I also just want to say that it's a numbers game. It is a tough market for everybody right now. Not just those who are on the registry, but everybody who's currently unemployed and seeking work or looking to find other employment. It's a tough market. It's really hard. If you attend our conference or if you want to look at some of our conferences in the past, I've done some things that also talk about how to adjust your resume in order to make sure that your resume is being looked at. But like I said, feel free, email me, and I'll be happy to kind of help you with your searching, and wish you all good luck.
Well, thank you, Sherry, for that information. You're a real expert in employment and specifically with helping people, including registrants convicted of felonies, to basically succeed in the job market. Somebody here employer made a comment. I don't know if you can see it or not, but it says super tough, I guess, to get a job. IA, I think it should be
AI.
AI.
Yeah.
Taking,
AI.
I guess that's, taking over job positions. What do you think about that? Is that one of the reasons it's hard to find a job these days?
I think AI has a lot to do with it. Not the fact that AI is taking over, but AI does a lot of the pre-screening of resumes when evaluating the applicants. So if you are not specifically putting in for certain keywords on your resume, it's not going to pick it up and it's not going to flag your resume for consideration. There are ChatGPT tools that you can use that you can upload your resume, make a copy of the job posting, and ask AI to make an update to your resume to match that specific job in order to help gain more traction on your application. But it's not necessarily because AI is taking over. It's just that AI is still being developed and it's not the best. So making sure that you put in those keywords will help gain better traction. But it's also, if you know somebody, that is also a great tool. Utilizing your resources, those who are already in that position, and networking. Networking is the biggest aspect in order to help, you know, gain some traction in regards to the job market.
Hey, well, great. Thank you. Since AI has been mentioned, I really feel obligated to say the following about AI. Folks, be really careful when you use it. I'm serious. I've had more than one person contact me who thought he knew the answer to a question, and the answer he got from AI was wrong. So wrong. And he would have basically marched forward into harm's way if he in fact had followed the information he got from AI. And here's another story, also true. A judge in the Midwest withdrew a decision. I've never heard of that happening before. So a judge issued a decision and then he withdrew it because he found out that his legal assistant had basically copied it from something AI gave him. And and they found out that there were cases cited that didn't even exist, that there were some statutes, some laws that were cited that didn't exist or were totally off point. So please, please, please be careful when you use AI, because just as Sherry said, AI is still relatively new. I don't know, maybe it's like they're in kindergarten or something. And, you know, they don't have all the right answers right now. And please, please, you know, check a source. I'm glad that one person asked me about the question. It had to do with, by the way, the international Megan's Law and whether or not it applied to him. And he thought because he was convicted of a misdemeanor offense, it didn't apply to him. And I said, oh, no, no, that is not true at all. In fact, it was one of the arguments I made when, in fact, we challenged the international Megan's Law. So folks, please, please be careful when you ask AI to do something for you. Okay. All right. Thank you for that commercial. Roger is another Axol board member. He's here today to talk about the, for many reasons, including talking about some recent experiences we've had with our website and some solutions that we found for those problems. Take it away, Roger.
Thanks, Janice. When you guys donate to us, we're very careful with that money. You behave very responsibly. And so one of the things that we've done to make our expenditures very frugal is we've had a, what I would equate to an economy car version of website hosting. We have great content, but we've got one of the least expensive plans, and that's worked well for a number of years, but we have had quite a few new people going to the website, and it's overloading our system. So what we did was we spent, I think it's like $20 more a month, $25 a month, not much, and we upgraded our website. So you shouldn't see any more of the times, maybe some of you found you were locked out occasionally in the past few months, the website wasn't responding. That shouldn't happen anymore, at least not for years. We got a really good deal and a lot more powerful web hosting. So just to let you know, we should have smooth sailing on that, and your donations are very much appreciated and we will use them effectively.
All right, Roger, thank you for that. And, you know, the interesting thing here, folks, is that when Roger came up with a new idea that was a very good idea, which is to send something out basically saying, hey, did you see these articles posted on the Axel website during the past week? And the first time he did it, our website got overloaded. And then I don't know if you want to describe it in greater detail, Roger, what happened?
Well, that's basically it, is because it is a super cool way to quickly look through our articles of the last week. In fact, I finished composing one right after this meeting. I'll send it out. If you guys could help me out by, as soon as you see it in your mailbox, click on one of the articles, hopefully more than one, and let's see how our, new website hosting is behaving. But I'm glad you guys like the new weekly email. Many organizations do that, that highlight their week's news articles. So please sign up for our email system or our texting system. It's on the right side of every page we have on our website. Just put your email in, or it tells you there what to do if you can't get email, how to get text messages. And I think you're really going to like it.
Thank you, Roger. By the way, there's a question for you in chat from man whose first name is Dan. So why don't you just answer it in chat rather than us talking about it? And folks, again, understand that we've had, actually in the very beginning, back in the day, we had what I called a Dick and Jane website. I mean, it was so basic, the website, right? And so it was interesting at one of our in-person meetings, and I still remember it was in Los Angeles at the ACLU building. And I said, we've got this Dick and Jane website. We really need to improve upon it. Is there anybody here today who can help us with that? And sure enough, somebody came up to us after the meeting. By the way, we're basically requesting volunteers, right? And she came up and she says, I have a smoking hot computer, and yeah, I can help. By the way, she's involved in this issue because, in fact, her son's on the registry. So she was our webmaster for many years. She moved on, literally, to Europe with her family. And so now, basically, Roger and another gentleman whose name is Chuck, they're the ones who, in fact, do all the magic, perform all the magic behind the scenes for our website. And I give them so much praise and thanks because I don't know a darn thing about it. It's kind of like electricity. I don't know about you all, but I just want to go to the wall and flip the switch and the electricity works, right? And I don't need to know about circuits and I don't need to know all these other things. The same thing with the website. However, comment when it crashes, trust me, so many people contact me and say it's crashed. There's problems with it. And so that's when I call Roger or call Chuck or call both Roger and Chuck. And we did have that situation just a couple of weeks ago. And they were great because they identified options that were available to the organization to again further upgrade our website. So anyway, I think we're in good shape right now, and I appreciate Roger and Chuck working on that so much. Thank you so much. Okay, let's talk about something else. Sometimes we have to talk about negative things, folks, and this is one of those times. We had one a member of our community who was brutally murdered earlier, about 30 days ago now. It's in Fremont, California, which is here in Northern California, and it was something like out of a horror movie, from what I read in the, in the media that was based upon police reports. So according to the media, what happened is somebody, a stranger came to his door and knocked on the door and he opened the door. And this man, falsely portrayed himself as a CPA and said he was new to town and he was looking for more CPA business. And then the next thing you know, he basically started attacking, the gentleman whose name is David Brimmer. So, and David, again, made a mistake by opening his front door. So, folks, I'm not an expert in this at all, but I think it's really important that we lock our front doors. And by the way, Frank Lindsay, who's another member of our board of directors, and I'm sure many of you have heard me refer to Frank Lindsay before. I mean, Frank Lindsay, he would say, he's an aging hippie, and he didn't think he needed to lock the front door of his house. And guess what? One day, a complete stranger walked into his house. By the way, somebody who was a victim of sexual abuse and just wanted to hurt somebody on the registry, didn't really care who it was. He basically broke into Frank. He didn't break into his house. He just walked in the front door, right? He didn't have to break into the house. He just walked in the front door and he tried to kill Frank in his own home. Well, fortunately, Frank was nimble and got out of his house. I mean, think about that. He actually, Frank had to run away from his own house in order to save his life. Unfortunately, Mr. Brimmer was not so fortunate. And so even though Mr. Brimmer escaped from his house, his assailant chased him 2 blocks until finally, he caught him and then he murdered him in somebody else's home. So this is something that we all need to think about. We need to protect ourselves to the best that we can. So especially people who are on the registry, or sometimes it's not just people on the registry, but people convicted of a felony, you're really limited in ways that you can defend yourself. So we have people here from all over the country. We're not going to make specific suggestions, but I mean, I think common sense says, please lock your front door. Ellie, I know that you said, you suggested online, you had a good suggestion, and lock your windows too, because, yeah, you know, just because they don't come in your front door, it's possible they could come in a window and stuff. And Frank Lindsay, who I just mentioned, he is a real big fan of wasp spray. So he gets wasp spray near his front door. Having said that, wasp spray is not going to stop a bullet. Okay. You just need to know that. But at least it might, it might get somebody's attention. It might stop them from attacking you. Maybe they can't aim properly or something if they do have a gun. But the first thing is, please do not open the front door to a person that you don't know. So, Roger, I know that you've been following some of the things that people have also said. Okay. Do you want to talk about this information you just put on there?
Yes. We wrote up some basic common sense things you can do to protect yourself. And again, it's not specific to any state. In general, weapons you want to stay away from. Each state is slightly different. I've seen a lot of chat on what forms a weapon. And here's the bottom line. You need to do your own research in your own state to determine what is legal and not. In general, ex-felons are not supposed to have any sort of thing designated even closely as a weapon. So please do the research yourself. I take a lot of precautions myself too, is I have a camera system, Ring camera system with floodlights. I have one at my front door. When someone rings it, I pull it up on my app and look at the face of the person, right? See who it is. I have my lights on outside. I spend a little extra money and replace the old front and back door with steel doors. They look like normal doors, but they're steel. And I don't go out late at night, you know, to different places. I'm very careful. Being observant, I think, is very important, right? Don't just walk along any time of day or night. Something could happen. So just be aware of what's going on around you. Normal precaution.
Hey, folks, if you're not speaking to the group, would you please mute yourself? We're getting some background chatter there. And, you know, what Roger's just saying is such valuable information. One other thing that I would recommend to people is go ahead and take a self-defense class, right? I'm not talking about martial arts, but there are some people out there who teach self-defense. And, you know, within a couple of hours, at least you can get some basic information about how to protect yourself. And, you know, Roger, there's a term for what you said earlier about, you know, it's called situational awareness. So it's, I think it's a military term, quite frankly, and maybe because I was in the military, I served in the Navy, or maybe it's because I worked in the Pentagon at some point in time in my career, that situational awareness is a term I'm really familiar with and I've practiced my whole life. And I don't know, Ellie, maybe too, because we're women, right, that we are maybe a little more aware of our surroundings than maybe some men are accustomed to looking.
If I could add to what Roger said, felons under California and federal law cannot own, use, or possess firearms. If somebody is on parole, that's a whole different thing. Being on parole, there's probably a condition that the person cannot own, use, or possess dangerous or deadly weapons. And so there's a distinction between those who are not on parole and those who are. The dangerous or deadly weapons would probably be like, you know, a knife, a dirk or dagger, baseball bat. So anybody on parole needs to check what condition he or she has, you know, in terms of, you know, possessing dangerous or deadly weapons. But a felon who's no longer on parole, it's the being unable to own, use, or possess firearms.
Yeah, thank you for that. And somebody named Jim, first name here, says PFRs might consider the Byrna, BYRNA, which is not a gun, but it is a weapon, and it's legal in all 50 states. I have no idea. I've never heard of what a BYRNA is. Maybe it's somebody, including Jim, who posted this comment. Maybe you can speak to that. I don't know what a Byrna is. Anybody here? Maybe somebody, former law enforcement?
Okay, can you hear me?
Yes, we can. Please.
Yeah, the Bernay is shoots a pellet like a round projectile, and they have those that have pepper, and they also have tear gas, and it will stop a grown man. And they've proved that several times. And you could go to Byrna.com, and it'll give you the information. They're not inexpensive, but they will stop somebody coming into your house.
Okay, well, so, they may not be inexpensive, but it sounds like they would be effective. And
they are effective, yes.
So Roger just put a link here in the chat about Byrnagun. Mm-hmm. All right. And also Roger made an important remark earlier, many remarks, but this one in particular, please check in your state to ensure that you can possess one legally. I hope Jim is right that they're legal in all states, but it's up to you to make sure of that. But again, I mean, I think self-defense makes a lot of sense as well for all of us, right? Which reminds myself, I need to take a self-defense class myself. You know, again, if Mr. Brimmer had only known, I mean, one, it was unfortunate he answered the front door to a stranger, but then on top of that, he really did not know how to defend himself. And again, this person chased him two blocks, and then eventually stabbed him to death. So, it really has hit me hard about the death of David Brimmer. I'm not quite sure why. Maybe because I can envision the scene in my head. I would like to erase that vision if I could. And it just sounds to me like something out of one of the horror movies about somebody being chased down there. Scott also put some information in about the Byrna guns. He says it's a pepper ball weapon for ball weapons. So maybe that's why it's legal. I don't know. Pepper spray, I understand, at least in California, is not legal. But according to Frank Lindsay, wasp spray is legal. and by the way, it has multiple purposes. If you ever have wasps, you can use it for that as well. Trying to make a little bit this serious and dark topic a little bit lighter. Sorry about that. Okay. So somebody else says Byrna guns incapacitate threats without causing permanent harm. Using CO2 cartridges to propel projectiles filled with chemical irritants like pepper spray or tear gas. Okay. Well, boy, I'm learning a lot today. Thank you. And that was Roger who gave us that new information. So does anybody have any questions or comments about self-defense at this point in time in general, or these Byrna guns in particular?
Okay. I just want to make an observation that somebody comes to your door or is trying to break in your door and, you know, they have a gun. It's probably not a good idea to say, wait a minute until I get my Byrna gun here. You know, the old adage is that you don't bring, you know, a pea shooter to a gunfight.
Right.
And a lot of this just involves common sense. You know, we don't know who comes, you know, to our door, and our tendency is first to look out to see who's there. And, you know, if somebody is intent on breaking in and they are armed, you know, with a gun, sometimes it's hard to just, you know, have your cell phone ready to call 911 too.
That's a good point too. Right there with you at the front door. Yeah. And you know, Roger, you said you have a Ring camera. I have one as well at my home and stuff. And I just don't answer the front door anymore if it's somebody I don't know. My neighbors, yes. My family, yes. But everybody else is a no. I don't care who they are. So, and we all have to make our decisions on what level of risk we're comfortable taking. But please, please, please protect yourself to the best of your ability. We need you. We love you. We support you. And we want you to stay here on planet Earth. So, all right, moving on. So let's talk about Section 8 housing. I, in fact, have been able to help somebody recently with Section 8 housing. In the past, I have helped probably dozens of people with obtaining Section 8 housing. And that's because of the following. There's a federal law that basically said that Section 8 housing, a person on the registry cannot either move into Section 8 housing or obtain Section 8 housing on their own behalf if, in fact, they're a lifetime registrant. So California and our new tiered registry law is basically making about half the people on the registry eligible for Section 8 housing. But guess what? The people that you're talking to and you're applying for Section 8 housing with may or may not know about the change in the law. They just, you know, it's like, oh, well, when they were trained 20 years ago, they were told that people on the registry did not qualify for Section 8 housing, and that's not true anymore. So in other states as well, if you're not required to register for life, you too can qualify for Section 8 housing. And this is really important. I'm happy to write memos for anybody who wants a memo to the effect if you're on tier 1 or you're tier 2, or by the way, if you're no longer on the registry, to write a memo that in fact you can share with the person, you know, making this decision. And, you know, it's ignorance on their part. I think most of the time it's not anybody trying to keep you from getting Section 8 housing. It's just they don't know that the law in fact has changed. So does anybody have any Section 8 housing questions before I move on? Okay. All right. So next thing I want to talk about is travel. I want to talk about international travel first, because actually there's some information on our website, not that we produce, but that somebody else produced, that's not accurate. So there's a system called ETIAS, and it stands for, maybe Roger, oh, here it is, the European Travel Information and Authorization System, okay? ETIAS. That has not started yet, okay? It's expected to start next year in the last quarter of 2026, not 2025, okay? And there's a whole bunch of initials here, and I hope it's not too confusing, so I'll do my best to clarify, and I might need to repeat myself. So the ETIAS system has not started. It's expected to start about a year from now. We shall see. It's been put off for many years, okay? And so that would require people to get a permit to go visit Europe, but it's not something that's required yet. So I don't want to get into too many of the details, but there's something else that has started there, and it's called the Entry Exit System, or the EES. Okay. So the EES has in fact started. Okay. It started actually this month. And in fact, it says it became operational on October 12th, and then it's going to be gradually rolled out during the next year. So I quite frankly don't understand what EES is, so I don't want to go into too many details, but well, here it goes. It says it's a new digital border control system being rolled out across the EU, European Union, starting in this month on October 25, with full implementation by April of next year. It replaces traditional passport stamping with a secure process that records biometric data, entry dates and exit dates, making border checks more accurate and efficient for travelers. I do not know how that can make it more efficient, but they say it does. Okay, so who has to do this? A visa-exempt travelers, okay, which says it includes nationals from countries exempted from applying for Schengen visa or short stay, and short stay visitors, those who require a visa to enter the Schengen area for a limited duration. So, again, I'm not quite sure about this. The only reason I brought up EES, and we'll put more information on the Excel website about the EES, is because there's a confusion, and I understand why, because these initials are very similar to each other. So the ETIAS system has not started yet. And in fact, it won't start for at least another year. The ETIAS system reminds me a lot of real IDs here in in the nation, right? So it's a federal requirement, these real IDs. And so for so many years, it kept getting delayed. But now it is the law of the land, which in fact, you need a real ID on your driver's license, or you may not be able to travel domestically. I mean, think about that. We can't travel within our own country. What I don't know, and maybe somebody who is on the call today does know, if you have a passport, can your passport replace the requirement for a real ID? I don't know that answer to that question. I sometimes test out the system myself. I have a passport card, and I know people on the registry are not allowed to get a passport card, currently required to register, that is. And so sometimes I use that at airports instead of my driver's license, just to see if in fact that will work. So far it has worked. And again, I'm just talking about domestic travel. So let's talk about domestic travel in general. I sometimes think that domestic travel is more difficult because it's more confusing than overseas travel. And you might wonder, why in the heck do I think that? It's because every single state in the nation has their own registration laws. Okay. And every state has a law that says, well, if you stay in our state, if you come to visit our state, past X number of days, or sometimes it's hours, then you will have to register in our state. And what's the downside if you don't register? Well, you too could be charged with and convicted of failing to register. So, you know, even though you're registering in a different state. The fact is, if you go to a different state, you go outside the state where you're registered, you may in fact trigger a registration requirement there. So which is, somebody asked which is hours. I'm really referring to Nevada, because Nevada doesn't say 2 days, they say 48 hours. So if you're in Nevada for more than 48 hours, you trigger the requirement to register there. So it's not that it's less than a day, but it's, they don't, that's how they word it. That's 48 hours, because sometimes it's confusing. You know, do you count the day that you arrive? Do you count the day that you depart, and figuring this out for different states? But the fact is that in Nevada, it is 48 hours. And folks, since I'm talking about Nevada, I just need to emphasize that Nevada includes Reno and Las Vegas. I don't know why, but some people still think that those are different locations. You're in the same state, so the 48 hours does apply. If you want to leave the state and come back, okay. But the fact is, don't go to Reno and Nevada for more than 48 hours, or guess what? You have triggered the requirement to register. And you might think, well, how are they going to know if I'm here more than 48 hours? Well, unfortunately, sometimes accidents happen, right? You could be in your car, you're driving safely, but the car behind you isn't, slammed into your vehicle, and you end up in the hospital. And what are they going to do? They're going to look you up in the hospital. Who is this person that in my hospital? And if they find out you're from out of state, you're required to register, and you haven't registered in the state of Nevada, you might in fact be in trouble. Okay. Dan asks, is there any update on those who've been removed from the registry being removed from the obligation to register in all other states? No, there's not an update, but this is probably the most confusing part about domestic travel. So for those of you who are no longer required to register, you may have to register if you go visit another state. And so I strongly recommend that you're extremely careful in traveling domestically, even if you're no longer required to register. And, you know, it's so confusing that I don't want to talk about any specific state at all, but I will just talk about two kind of approaches. So approach number one that I recommend actually for most people is just, you can stay safe if you act as if you're still on the registry when you go visit another state. So I've mentioned Nevada now, 48 hours. Well, for 48 hours, then even if you're not required to register, let's just say here in California, you might trigger a registration requirement in Nevada. And the reason things are so uncertain is because these different states, they don't say... These different states have different requirements for who has to register in their own state due to an in-state conviction. And so sometimes we lawyers, right, Ellie, we have to compare like the elements of the crime in this, let's just say in California. And then if you're going to go visit Nevada, what are the elements of the crimes in Nevada? And by the way, even though some of the crimes have the same names, some of them do not. I mean, rape is rape. I think in most states, though statutory rape can make you really crazy. But then there's others like what is sexual assault? What is sexual battery? And those crimes, even though they have the same or similar names, are treated very differently in different states. So again, the cheap and easy way to do it is when you travel domestically, and these are for people who are no longer required to register, just act as if you're still required to register. Okay. Now, if you want to do something different, then I recommend that you go hire an attorney in the state that you want to visit. Now, if you're going to go there for a couple of days on a business trip or for pleasure, doesn't pay you to do that? Probably not. But let's just say you go on a regular basis to go visit your aunt and uncle in another state. Let's just choose Texas. Then I really recommend that you talk to a Texas attorney to find out about the laws in Texas and whether or not you'd be required to register there. Okay. So again, the trouble and the expense of hiring an attorney probably would be worthwhile if there's a state that you plan to visit on a regular basis. Maybe you have, you know, lots of relatives in one state and then you want to go there on a regular basis and you'd like to avoid registering if you can, then again, it might be a good idea for you to hire an attorney in that state. So somebody here says Texas is 6 days the limit. I'm not sure if that's right or not. Somebody else says the United States aren't united as far as laws go. That's certainly true. And you know, in general, folks, just so you know, so supposedly laws that deal with things like safety and criminal offenses are unique to each and every state. I mean, there certainly are some federal offenses and such, but in general, the general rule is that state law basically addresses health and safety in their state. And that's why there's so much, you know, confusion and uncertainty when you go visit another state. Is there a best state? The state that you can visit the longest is Hawaii. So Hawaii, you can go there for 10 days before you trigger the requirement to register. That's 10 days for each and every trip you make to Hawaii. They do have a 30-day limit per calendar year. So you could go to Hawaii three times and you could spend 30 days there total, okay, without having to register there. This is for a person, you know, who in fact is required to register. And again, my rule of thumb is if you're no longer required to register, but you were registering at one time, there is that. So I think I answered that question. So let's talk about overseas travel. I mentioned these two, ETIAS and the EES. And again, ETIAS, I know we've been following for some time. It's a permit process. So, you know, most of the time we Americans don't even have to get visas to go visit countries in Europe, but now you're going to have to get a permit. And there's uncertainty there, right? So, and many countries in Europe, they have the right to be forgotten. I mean, isn't that a wonderful thing to think about? So in Europe, they say, oh, what happened more than 10 years ago? We don't care about that. You have a right to be forgotten if you, in fact, were convicted of an offense. But of course, the United States doesn't have that. But you know, getting back to it, it's a permit. Supposedly, it's something that you would apply for online. And this is the part that's confusing to me. And maybe what's holding up the system from being started is, in fact, supposedly it's going to be added electronically to your passport. So how the heck that works is beyond my understanding. Maybe some of you who are IT experts, words you can understand and explain to the rest of us. But the fact is that that's beyond my understanding. All right. So Dan wants to know, how far out in the ocean could one travel to not be in Hawaii and then go back? I don't know the answer to that question. That's a really interesting question that you're asking. Maybe is there another country nearby? I don't know, by ship or by plane. But you'd have to leave Hawaii before you go back. And remember, there's also a 30-day limit. Annually. JJ says that in Oregon, there is no limit to visit. I don't know if that's true or not. I don't have my charts in front of me, but I hope it's true. Another person says, I want to mention this too, when it comes to Washington, D.C., at this point in time, you can go visit Washington, D.C. as long as you want, and you never have to register. Okay. So Washington, D.C. is another place you can go where you don't have to register. There's no fear of triggering a registration requirement in D.C. as long as you're going there to visit. But the fact is, if you're going to move to DC permanently, you will have to register. You might have to register. You need to check in with DC. All right. So somebody is asking, what is the best strategy to rent an apartment? Do I be transparent to the landlord or on the application? Well, doesn't have anything to do with travel, but let's just go ahead and address it now. Folks, there's a law in California. It's Penal Code Section 290.46, subsection J. Okay. It basically says that a whole groups of people cannot discriminate against you solely based upon the fact that you're on the registry. That's the good news. Okay. What's the bad news? The bad news is there's an exception, and that is to protect a person at risk, to protect a person at risk. And unfortunately, there have been court decisions out there that say protecting a person at risk, like in an employment situation, could in fact be the customers or could be fellow employees. And then when it comes to housing, unfortunately for the landlord, it could in fact be your neighbors. So the best strategy that I know to rent an apartment is get somebody else to rent the apartment in their name and then have you added on later. So I know a person, a gentleman who did this successfully. He had a sister apply for the apartment. She had great credit and everything else. And so she was able to get the apartment in her name. And then he was added on as, oh, somebody else who was going to live there. And they didn't run a credit check on him. So, and folks, I just said something really important about credit checks, okay? So credit checks are what often trip up people on the registry when it comes to employment and or house, because that is where it will tell the person, your potential landlord or your potential employer, that in fact you're currently on the registry. So there are some jurisdictions in California, like Los Angeles, that supposedly they are not supposed to consider if you've been convicted more than 7 years ago. But here's the problem. Here's the issue. If you're currently on the registry, it's not more than 7 years ago. And that comes up, and many times people are in fact denied employment or they're denied housing. Okay, somebody's put in here something about the Restorative Action Alliance. That's great. They have a free webinar this coming Wednesday, and it has to do with registrants and family members with the title Finding Light in a Difficult Season, Coping with the Others. And there's a link there. Again, this is in chat if you want to try that. Somebody else said in Colorado, 14 days consecutive, but only per year. But only what per year? I'm not sure. So folks, if you're going to travel domestically, please, please do your homework. One of the things I have found out in the years of talking about this is if you want to visit a state, guess what way is pretty easy to do it is by train. So if you travel by train, you're not going to spend more than 24 hours in any state, I don't think. Maybe Texas might be the exception because it's so big. But the fact is that most states, you're not going to be there for more than 24 hours. And as far as I know, there's no state that requires registration in less than 24 hours if you visit. But if you're going to travel by train, please be prepared that in case the train breaks down, you might have to rent a car and get out of that state so that you don't trigger a registration requirement. And folks, why are we telling you this? And you know, every month I repeat myself that you do not want to register in more than one state. And I don't say that lightly. The reason you don't want to is because if, let's say you live in California and you are able to petition for removal from the registry in California, right? Well, guess what? You don't have to have a unique identifier added to your passport. I mean, that's a huge, huge benefit, right? But if you're required to register in any other state, they will add the unique identifier to passport. And there's two states out there that are just notorious from keeping you on their registry forever. One of them is Florida and the other one's New York. Okay. Well, somebody told me just this morning that he was able to get off the New York registry, but it sounded like he had a misdemeanor or maybe it was a light felony conviction. But in general, those two states don't take people off the registry. And so, you know, if in fact, let's just say you're in California, you get off the California registry, but if in fact you visited Florida in the past, Florida keeps you on their registry for your entire life. They don't care if you ever come back to visit, but you're on their registry, then in fact, you may have to have that unique identifier added to your passport. Ellie, is there anything that you want to add here about either overseas or domestic travel? Ellie, do you want to unmute yourself?
There you go. No, I was looking up Oregon. Somebody asked about Oregon. So I was looking up if one visits Oregon, what are the restrictions for or the time limit for registering as a visitor? I'll put that in the chat once I find it.
Okay. All right. So speaking of jurisdictional differences, I'm reading something in the chat. For those folks who have to register, you spoke about international and domestic travel, but what about a county where a registrant lives in Contra Costa, but sometimes sleeps over at a family place in a different county, like San Francisco? Does the individual need to register in both counties? Probably not. It all depends on how much time you spend at that other residence, believe it or not. So California is not a SORNA compliant state, and most states are not. Two-thirds of the states are not SORNA compliant. Oops, I'm just realizing I'm not on video. Okay, but you can still hear me, right? Okay, so in non-SORNA states, you can travel within your same state without having to register at a second location unless you regularly reside there. Right. And trust me, in California, the definition of that term regularly resides is not clear. In fact, there's case law that say many different things. So please be careful about where you spend your time. If you own a home, I should say that. Yeah. If you visit a location outside of your current county or current city on a very regular basis, you might need to register there as well. In California, it's called concurrent registration. Okay. And if you don't do concurrent registration, you could in fact be found guilty of failing to register. So here's one example. This is a real case in California. There was a gentleman who was a caretaker for an elderly person, and he worked there Monday through Friday, like from 9 to 5. He never spent the night there. He didn't get his mail there. He didn't shower. There are all these things that sometimes people use as factors. But he was found to be in violation or for failing to register because, in fact, he didn't register, again, at a place where he was employed. I mean, I think that's a terrible, terrible thing. But that's one of the cases we have out there. That's why I have to say that there's not total clarity when it comes to when somebody needs to register at a second location. And I would ask again, we're hearing some background noise. If you're not speaking to the group, would you please mute yourself? I'd appreciate it. Thanks so much. Okay. So Oregon, registration required within 10 days for visits of 14 days or longer. So, okay. It sounds like then that the registration requirement isn't triggered unless you stay for 14 days or longer. However, if you plan to stay 14 days or longer, you better register within 10 days. That's not exactly clear. Maybe I'm thinking too much like a lawyer. It's like, I can come up with all kinds of questions about that. Okay. I recently had my felony conviction reduced to a misdemeanor. How do I get my tier 3 status reduced to tier 1? That's from Rick in Oakland. Rick, And anybody who wants to know what their tier assignment is, you need to go to the office where you register and ask for something called a form 8050-8050. Maybe you could type that in, Roger, if you don't mind. So form 8050, and the name of the form is proof of current registration. It's a two-page form. This is not the same form as your annual registration, okay? And on the first page of that form, it will list your tier assignment. Now, if you've had this reduction, hopefully it says tier one, but if it doesn't, contact me and I can help you get DOJ to correct your tier assignment. Okay, and there's another new message here. If you own multiple locations in California and stay infrequently at them, do you still need to register in those cities? Here we go. The typical lawyer answer. It depends. It depends. And I'm serious, everybody. I wish I could speak with greater precision and clarity, but I can't, because the term is, where do you regularly reside? Courts have looked at things like, honest to God, where do you get mail? Do you spend the night there? But none of these one factors is determining. They're looking at all these things. Do you take showers there? In one case that I was successful in challenging, they said because his drum set was at his girlfriend's house. They wanted to charge him with failing to register because he wasn't registered at his girlfriend's house. That I thought was ridiculous. Unfortunately, I was able to convince the judge of that. But in fact, we did have to go to court to get that clarified. So, and Roger, can you sex offender registration and exclusion forms? Why did you put that there, please?
Sorry, did I miss here? Which form did you want me to put on there?
I'm not asking you to put a form on. You just put one on there, a link. So why did you put that on there?
What was it you asked me to get a link to? You wanted me to post a link to?
Never mind. This is just getting too confusing. Okay, moving on. Moving on. So some of you know that I mentioned before
question,
something about
Janice.
Ellie, what?
Janice, I have a question.
Oh, please, yes.
When the person who was on tier three and got his conviction reduced to a misdemeanor, is this one of those Manzor issues that's a can of worms?
Yeah, Ellie, I didn't even want to mention that case. Okay, I think we should avoid it for now because there's a lack of clarity there, a huge lack of clarity.
Yeah, but that's why I call it a can of worms.
Yeah. So just know that it's not 100% certain that if you get your felony reduced to misdemeanor, that you will be, in fact, have your tier assignment reduced from tier three to tier one. There's some ambiguity here. There's a case that is on appeal right now, and we're waiting anxiously to get the results of that, but the result won't come back probably for another year or so. So I hope I answered the question about the person who said the thing about owning. I think you own homes or in multiple locations in California. But let me put it this way. If you own multiple homes and you don't live in at these other houses, you certainly do not have to register at those houses. The question is whether or not you regularly reside at any of those locations. Okay. And so I have one client who is a wealthy man. He has four different homes. So out of an abundance of caution, he has decided that he's going to register at each of the four homes. That's his decision, right? He doesn't know if he's really required to do that or not, but he's like, you know what? I don't want to have to worry about this. So I'm just going to go ahead and register at all those four homes. By the way, nobody else lives at the four homes. So that gets more ambiguous. Like, again, if you're going to go visit Aunt Martha, but you're going to be there for a month, does that mean you regularly reside there? I don't know. And the law just isn't clear. So understand that Ellie and I can meet with you privately so that we can help you address the situation and give you some clarity, some guidance on it. But unfortunately, the cases are so, the cases themselves have created a lot of uncertainty. So I'm sorry to say that, but that's true. Okay, so somebody's asking about polygraph exams. Let's not talk about that yet. We'll talk about that in a little while. But let's go on to SORNA litigation. There is a lawsuit, a very important lawsuit that's pending in federal district court right now here in California. We are not the litigators, but instead we're a party in the case. So the litigators in the case is another organization that has it's a lot larger and has a lot more resources than we do. It's called the Pacific Legal Foundation. So PLF filed a lawsuit now about 2 years ago, basically challenging SORNA regulation. And the regulations that they're challenging are really very onerous. And you know, they basically require people to do all kinds of things, including a lot of people to register four times a year. So in California, and I think in most states, most people register once a year. But in California, there's a great group of people, those convicted of 288 subparagraph A, lewd, lascivious acts under 14, that would have to register four times a year. So anyway, this litigation is pending. Both sides are doing their best to get to a decision. The judge, for whatever reason, keeps delaying the next hearing in the case. So originally the hearing was going to be in May, and now the new hearing date is November 10th. And the judge didn't make one leap there. It's like every time we get even close to the hearing date, guess what? He changes the date again. And he usually does it the Friday before the hearing. So there's usually not much advance notice, but it's something that we're really concerned about. Because one of the arguments the government is making in this case is that anybody who has ever been required to register is subject to SORNA. I hope to hell that is not true now or in the future, because in fact, 2/3 of the states in our nation have said thanks, but no thanks to the SORNA, Sex Offense Registration and Notification Act, which again is a federal law, and it's voluntary for the states whether or not they're going to basically comply with it. And again, 2/3 of the states have said no, thank you. So I believe it's 17 states that in fact are SORNA compliant. I'm very happy that SORNA is not. Okay. So Jim says people in Missouri are required to register four times a year. I'm sorry to hear that. But in California, most people register only once. And by the way, also in California, people don't pay to register. I understand in some states that in fact you have to pay for registration, and that is a terrible thing. Okay. So I'm taking it out of order, but somebody is now asking about polygraph exams and being required by some agencies. Folks, if you're in California, there is something called the containment model, and the polygraph exam is part of the containment model. I don't agree with the containment model. I sure as heck don't agree with people having to take polygraph exams, but that's what the law says. So if you're on parole, everybody on parole has to take polygraph exams. I don't think people on probation take polygraph exams, but I could be wrong. And again, this is people who have been convicted under California state law. But this is a weird thing about the polygraph. Supposedly, the sole purpose for having to take a polygraph exam in California when you're on parole is to help you with treatment. And then, in fact, the results of your polygraph exam cannot be used against you and for criminal purposes. So in other words, if you were to disclose during a polygraph exam that, in fact, you had sex with a 14-year-old 20 years ago, you know, they can't use that against you, and basically you can't be charged with a new sex offense. But I just you know, can't understand how terrible that would be to have to take a polygraph exam. And somebody in this question here about polygraphs, so I had an exam a month ago, and the examiner just got angry with me because he said I was too relaxed. What? And that the results were not conclusive or inconclusive rather. So you know what, folks, I can't even imagine that is a valid reason to basically say your polygraph was inconclusive. But I will tell you another person, one of my clients, he was told that he failed his polygraph exam because even though he answered the question truthfully, his sphincter tightened when he was answered the question. I'm sorry. What? I'll have to mask it. All it makes me think of is he was basically being polite and not farting in front of the polygraph examiner, right? So he tightened up his sphincter. And so that meant the polygrapher thought that he was basically not answering the question truthfully. So that's it's junk science, folks. Everybody agrees it's junk science, the polygraphs. Courts will not accept it as evidence of anything. And so here we are, unfortunately, in California, if you're on parole, you're going to have to go through these polygraph exams. And by the way, if you fail the polygraph exam, it will be used against you when it comes to treatment, but they were not going to drag you into a criminal court and charge you with any crime. So I guess that's good news. Silver lining to a dark cloud, perhaps. Okay. Oh my goodness. 5 new messages. Here we go. People telling us about how many times they're registering in other states. It looks like in Maryland, you do 4 times a year. Texas, you have to renew your driver's license every year. Cost you $30, I think that person's saying. People on probation are required to take polygraph exams. Okay, thank you for letting me know. And I think in some places, people end up paying for their polygraph exams, and the cost is over $100 a year. Not a year, but a polygraph. And so most people in California are taking polygraphs twice a year, not once a year, but twice. And so I don't think at least people on parole are having to pay for them. I'm not sure about people on probation. Okay, so let's talk about another topic. I filed a lawsuit just a couple of months months ago about California's Department of Corrections. Once again, they were doing something that was stupid and also illegal. This time it had to do with females on the registry. We don't have a lot of females on the registry, about 135, to let you know. And so 135 of them. But when we got the statistics back under a Public Records Act request, it turned out that 130 of them were considered high risk. I mean, think about what percentage that is. It's a really, really high percentage, and it didn't really make any sense. So we dug into the issue, and what we found out was that, in fact, the Department of Corrections basically created their own tool how they were going to evaluate women on the registry and whether or not they were likely to commit another sex offense. And so it was bogus, because in California state law requires tools for risk assessment to be validated. And that's a really important word, is validated. And even though I'm talking specifically about California, the fact is, overall, and this is not even just in the United States, but overall in the world, women on the registry reoffend, that is, commit a second sex offense very rarely. I mean, the percentage is so darn low that it's not even measurable. And not only that, because there's so few women on the registry in any state or nation, that there's no way to validate the test. Now, this is not my personal opinion. It's the opinion of, it's a professional opinion from Dr. Franca Cortoni, who's from Canada, and she and Dr. Carl Hansen, who I would imagine many of you know because of Dr. Carl Hansen and his relationship Static 99. They just recently published an article. It was in fact sent to me a couple days ago that talked about women on the registry. And that's exactly what they say, that it's impossible to validate a risk assessment tool for women on the registry because there are so few women on the registry. So we sued them. And guess what? We're very close now to, in fact, finalizing a settlement agreement. And then one of the important terms of the settlement agreement, which I'll mention today, is in fact they will stop using that tool that they created. It's called the FSORA, F-S-O-R-A. Dan, are you giving me a trophy there? If so, I appreciate it. Thank you. And, you know, this is not the first time we've caught the Department of Corrections doing something stupid and possibly illegal. So we did, in fact, file another lawsuit against the Department of Corrections probably about 2 years ago, or maybe it was even just 18 months ago, where basically the Department of Corrections had, get this, they had an illegal policy that they didn't even put in writing. It was not written anywhere, but this is, had the policy, and indeed that's what they were doing, which is they're requiring every single registrant the entire time they're on parole to undergo treatment. And guess what? The law said something completely different. So we caught them in the act of doing something illegal, and they went, oops, okay. So, in fact, we settled that case. That case got settled through, in large part, their issuance of new regulations saying that they weren't going to do that anymore. And in fact, they were going to have containment meetings. And during the containment meeting, then they were going to tell the person on the registry if, in fact, they needed more treatment. Okay, so in the meeting, they tell you whether or not you need more treatment, why, and even more importantly, they were going to put that decision in writing, including the reason for continuing treatment. And the most important part of that regulation is then they were going to give that document to the person, to the registrant. The problem with that, and that, by the way, those regulations were issued almost exactly a year ago in October 2024. I have gotten so many complaints from people who are telling me that they're not getting the document. And the regulation is very clear in saying that the document has to say if indeed you are to continue treatment, the reason you can have to continue treatment, and also, by the way, that document has to be given to the registrant within 30 days, within 30 days of the containment. So if they're not, it's not happening. So we're getting close to filing another lawsuit. And I think somebody asked me that question earlier in this meeting over in the chat room. So folks, you know, again, if you're in California and you're on parole, you do have rights, and CDCR needs to comply with their own regulations. You know, I'm not going to let them get away with passing some regulation that says all the right things and then them not implement them. So if you're one of the people who in fact has been affected by this, please contact me. Not today. If you can wait till Monday, please. Contact me. And Roger, maybe you can put my email address and my phone number in the chat room one more time so people do that. Well, okay, somebody says San Francisco kept me on for 9 years and put in my document. I would still be benefited by more treatment. Okay, what a bunch of nonsense. 9 freaking years in treatment. I mean, you know, I think treatment treatment is important, but on the a sharper future, not my favorite treatment provider to start with. And I hope we all understand that there's a lot of profit motive here when it comes to treatment on both sides, on the government side and also about the treatment providers. So both of them are financially rewarded by having as many people on parole and in treatment as possible. So if you can imagine, then the treatment provider doesn't want to advance you forward, say, heaven forbid that you completed treatment, right? Oh no, more treatment would be better. Okay. Well, many times it's a bunch of nonsense. However, saying that, folks, that document that's supposed to be produced, you know, if it says you've been violated on parole three times, if you have failed two polygraph exams or whatever it is, I mean, there are valid reasons to keep people in treatment, but there's also invalid reasons as well. Yeah. And so I'm sure with Sharper Future, and I heard they keep you in the program because it's all about money. Absolutely. It's just for the treatment provider, and it's also for CDCR, because CDCR's budget gets bigger if, in fact, they have more people on parole. I mean, it's about the money, and whoever said it so long ago, follow the money, or, yeah, as I'm thinking about a movie, too, which I can't remember the name of, so I won't. Powerball, wasn't it Powerball? It was about the money as well. So a lot of people are making a lot of money. I have a copy of one contract with one treatment provider. The contract amount is $16.4 million. $16.4 million. It's for a four-year period, so, oh, it's only $4 million a year, but it only covers 300 people. And so if some mathematician that's listening today or later to the recording, you can figure out how many treatment providers it is and how many millions of dollars are being given to treatment providers, right? Because there's over 7,000 people in California who are both on the registry and on parole, over 7,000. And so for every group of 300, and they're given $4 million a year, that's a heck of a lot of money. So the treatment providers have absolutely no incentive. In fact, they have the opposite of incentive. Their incentive is to keep you in treatment and not to graduate you from the treatment program. By the way, I have also heard from some treatment providers who are fed up with the system and knowing they're aware that it doesn't work. So how do I challenge from keeping me from moving forward to the next phase? I also have a guy in my group who's been on for 10 years. Oh my God, now he has cancer. Oh my God. Okay, so Stephen, that you put your first name there, contact me please during the week, okay, so we can talk about this, because I will tell you, I am chomping at the bit. I do want to sue CDCR again. They are not implementing their regulations and they're harming people left and right. And so please contact me and see if maybe you can become a plaintiff. Somebody's name I cannot pronounce. I'm sorry. If someone is telling the truth and has been complying 100% with their regulatory requirements, I guess, but poly results indicate lying, how does the poly examiner interpret a report? I guess they say it's either conclusive or that you failed the polygraph. And so I said that thing about, you know, one of my clients and stuff, and he tightened up his sphincter during the polygraph exam, and they thought that was that meant he wasn't telling the truth. I think that's absolutely ridiculous myself. But And I didn't know this until that situation. I guess they have you sit on some kind of pad, some electronic with electronics in it, and so they know if you've tightened up your sphincter. And some people here are nodding their head yes, and Dan also said yes. So, oh my gosh, how intrusive can that be? I don't know. there's a little bit of a rebel in me. I would say that maybe one idea would be interesting to see. What if you ate a whole lot of beans before your polygraph exam and you didn't hold it in, right? And say, oh, well, I wanted to make sure I passed my polygraph. Oh, well, that's right. He should have just let it rip. So anyway, back to the law. Shall we go back to the law? Okay. Another lawsuit that we have filed, and we're successful in doing it. We sued the Department of Justice this time, Department of Corrections. Yeah, we sue them on a regular basis. We don't sue the Department of Justice as often, but we do sue them from time to time. And I do remember how nervous I was the first time before we sued them the first time, and thinking, oh my gosh, we're going to sue a whole agency full of lawyers. Yikes. What are we thinking here? But you know what? Our first lawsuit was successful, and every lawsuit since then has been successful as well, including the one I'm about to tell you. So this one had to do with tier assignment. So under our tiered registry law, people are assigned to tiers based upon their conviction offense. And what Department of Justice was doing, and they're the ones that make the tier designations, they were basically saying that even if you were merely convicted of an attempted offense, you're going to be on the same tier as a person who was convicted as a completed offense. And always what comes to mind with me is rape. So rape is on tier three. We probably will never get it off of tier three, folks. I'm sorry to say, but it's on tier three. What we're trying to do is trying to create an off ramp so that people in tier three will have an opportunity to do a petition, but that's not the law yet. But anyway, so, you know, just think about it. If somebody unzips a zipper and says, hey, this is what I'm going to do to you, X, Y, and Z, and then they think, and the person says no, and the person goes, okay, and walks away, maybe that's attempted rape, okay? Maybe. And the fact is, if in fact you're convicted of attempted rape or you plead guilty to attempted rape, you sure as hell do not belong on the same tier as somebody who actually completed the rape, okay? So so this was a really important lawsuit. Again, as I said, we're successful. Many people have changed from tier three down to tier one, the lowest tier, though some people you just go from tier three down to tier two. It just depends on the conviction offense. But this was an important lawsuit. We won, and I love talking about it. So Roger, do you want to give a commercial here about donations? You do it so well.
Thanks. Yeah, like I mentioned earlier, we use all the money you donate to fight for you. That's what we're here for, right? And as Janice has said, we sure have a lot of success. You know, we don't perform miracles, but the stuff that we do is having even national influence and helping some of you in your own states. So I just encourage you to consider, think of all the money you've had to spend, you know, on attorneys in the past and legal stuff. And all we're asking for is a reasonable donation that you can afford to do regularly, because we can't do this without funds, right? And we don't have big offices or huge staffs. We just don't. It's not what we are. But there are expenses to do these lawsuits, to have a Zoom account, all these other things. It adds up. So really, please consider donating to us regularly, and you'll have the satisfaction of knowing that we're fighting for you. And consider putting us in your estate planning. Have a forever influence. I put Axol in my will, so I just encourage you guys to do the same. Thanks. Now, and the donation is on every page on the right side. Just click on that.
So, Roger, somebody here is asking for a link to the donate. Would you please put that in there?
Sure.
Okay, thank you. And folks, we're serious about this. We've applied for grants in the past, and I guess you won't be surprised to learn that we always get turned down for grants. But so the fact is, you know, the reason that we are able to do the work that we do is because of private donations. So please, please consider making a donation, whether it's a one-time donation or many people choose to donate on a regular, monthly basis. You can do that when you go to the website. Okay. And maybe, Roger, after you put in the link, maybe put in the address. So some of us who are old-fashioned can actually send a check of the organization and our office here in Sacramento. And by the way, it's a virtual office. We pay like $70 a month to get mail there. That's it. Okay. Okay. Thank you. All right. So let's move on to the tiered registry law. And Ellie, if you don't mind initiating the discussion, I'd appreciate it.
Sure. California's tiered registry law just had a significant change. And now individuals who are convicted and this will be effective January 1st of 2026, individuals convicted of 261.5, which I believe is misnamed as statutory rape because there's no rape involved. It's just intercourse with somebody who's underage by about 10 years. That's now going to be a registrable offense. Even though KSOM and other groups like Axol were opposed to that law. But in regard to the tiered registry law, as you know, because we've talked about this in the past, the tiers are now tier one, where registration is required for 10 years, tier two, where registration is required for 20 years, and tier three, which still requires lifetime registration. So the process is that one who registers needs to go to the law enforcement agency where he or she registers in order to obtain proof of current registration. And that starts the ball rolling. I think Janice would agree that individuals who want their registration terminated because they're in tier one or tier two should probably have a lawyer by their side, because, you know, sometimes the prosecutor doesn't always follow the rules, and sometimes the judges act as another prosecutor. But the forms are quite simple. They need to be given to the district attorney where the offense occurred, to the district attorney if the individual resides in another county, and also to the law enforcement where the incident occurred, and also law enforcement where the person registers if it's different from the agency or the county from where the incident occurred. One of the issues I think that we find is people with out-of-state convictions. When the Department of Justice tries to convert that to an offense under California law. And I think that is sometimes confusing for individuals. If they're convicted in federal court in another state and they move to California, the Department of Justice has to find, you know, the equal statute in California. And also in other state courts, I have a client who had something going on in New York, and it was converted to sexual battery here in California, and he doesn't know why. Well, you know, when you have those older convictions, it's a little more difficult. But going back to California and getting removed from the tier registry law, the petition is served on the district attorney, and the law enforcement agency and the law enforcement agency has to determine if the individual has the requisite number of years for registration. And there are different scenarios that could add time to, say, if somebody's in tier one, if they pick up a failure to register, then it's not necessarily 10 years. There's maybe another year or two added because picking up a failure to register conviction. I had a client who was convicted of skinny dipping in a motel pool, and I'm sure some of you have heard this story, and he ended up going to prison on something else. And so it took law enforcement additional time to figure out if he had the 10 years, because subsequent time spent in custody does not count for the 10 or 20 years. Anyway, it's, you know, it seems rather simple. And like I said, you know, Janice and I would probably both agree that one should, you know, get a lawyer. There are some agencies who do it pro bono, where there's no charge. Sometimes individuals rely on the public defender because the public defender offices in every county should be able to provide that service. But one of our board members is a lawyer in San Luis Obispo, Jeff Stein, and he believes supporting documents should be presented to the district attorney after the initial petition is filed. And he takes on private clients, and sometimes they get a psychological report. And usually, in many cases, the report says the person is no longer a threat to the community. Those reports are expensive, and for people with a lack of funds, that not only sometimes is cost prohibitive, but I think it's Janice has mentioned, once in one of her cases, the judge ordered the probation department to provide one of those psychological assessments, and probation said no. But anyway, you know,
because the person wasn't on probation.
Right. And so, you know, anybody, you know, who is in tier one or tier two, definitely go to the police agency in California where you register and get that tier assignment letter to see in what tier you're on, because that's also gives you an idea of, you know, when you will be eligible to start filing the petition to be removed from the registration.
Yeah, thank you, Ellie, for that information about the tiered registry law. I'm very pleased to report that 135 of my clients so far have gotten off the registry. That's 135 out of 136, by the way. And the only person who didn't get off is because he lived 10 years out of in Mexico. Okay. And that they held that against him. You know, we said, look, he wasn't there, you know, drinking margaritas on the beach in Mexico. He was there working. He lived there with his wife. They had a successful business, etc. And it was impossible for him to register during that time. And by the way, he didn't commit another sex offense during the 10 years that he was in Mexico. But I could not persuade the judge otherwise. But the fact is, we, you know, we really have an advantage right now for people who petition for removal from the registry. There are two appellate decisions that are really in our favor that explain very clearly that it's a district attorney who has the burden to prove that you pose a current danger. So that was what we argued initially. I know that's an argument that I made initially. But the fact is that I was kind of blustering my way forward there until these two appellate court decisions. One's called People versus Tye and the other one People versus Franco. And those decisions said, hey, district attorney, you have to prove that this person has does indeed pose a current danger before you can, in fact, recommend you know, that they continue their registration. So it's still not a slam dunk. There are still DAs who do object to petitions. I will share a story with you because it's one of my favorite stories about this. And there was a deputy DA in Los Angeles County who objected to a petition I filed on behalf of a female registrant who had been on the registry for more than 30 years. I believe she was a tier two, which only required 20 years. No risk, you know, there was no reoffense, nothing at all. And I just couldn't understand why, in fact, he had objected to the petition. So I called him up and I asked, why? Why did you, in fact, object to this petition? And this is literally what he said, because we can. That's what DA say sometimes, because we can. And, you know, the fact is that he was a young attorney. And I thought to myself, this is a young attorney who needs to be educated. So I did my best to educate him. And guess what? She got her petition granted by a judge, even though we had to go through a hearing and everything else. And it really was a waste of time and money for her to have to go through that hearing, but it had to be done. And again, not so many judges, not so many DAs object to petitions anymore. So somebody asked, is there any hope on the horizon for people assigned to Tier 3? I think so. One of the things so the tiered registry law was passed in 2017, which seems like ancient history now. It didn't become effective until 2021, right? And every year since 2017, when the law was passed, our organization has been lobbying the state legislature to create an off-ramp. And what I mean by that, create an opportunity for people assigned to Tier 3 to petition for removal. Now, at this point in time, the only thing that we think that we might be successful at is saying after 30 years. Why do I say that? Because Tier 1 is 10 years, Tier 2 is 20 years, and, you know, the symmetry of it all is 30 years. So that's what we have requested. We did bring that suggestion to the Sex Offender Management Board, and they have not embraced it yet. They said they just need more time to figure it out. I think they don't want to make everybody who's on Tier 3 eligible. That makes no sense to me. I mean, folks, even if you were convicted of the most serious and violent offense, I'd say after 30 years, you're not the same person that you were 30 years before, and that you should be eligible to petition. And doesn't mean you're actually going to get off the registry. It means that you can go before a judge, right? And in fact, the judge can decide whether or not to grant your petition. So, so John, I don't know what you're saying here. I think it's too cryptic for me to read and understand. A Christmas letter. No. So why don't you join us verbally, and then maybe you can ask a question in a different way. But I don't know what you're asking there. Ellie, can you see the question in chat? And maybe you could figure out. See, last year, Tier 3 to Tier 1 attempted statue or two. I don't know what you're asking, John. So I'm serious. I'm encouraging you to unmute yourself and ask a question. So let's talk a little bit more about this process. Ellie, I have to admit, I stepped away to use the restroom while you were talking. I'm not sure you mentioned this or not. I think I heard you say something about it, but I want to emphasize, if in fact, you know, it is possible that you can in fact file your own petition. It's possible that you can serve who needs to be served, but many people don't want to do that because it is complicated. It's kind of like a logistics issue or problem. And so many people who want to petition do hire a legal professional to help them. And you can make your own decision there about whether or not you want to file your own petition. But folks, if a DA objects to your petition, please, please, please get legal representation. Go to your public defender's office, hire Ellie, hire me, hire Jeff Stein, you know, who's another one of our board members, but please get legal representation because it's a court hearing. And you don't, you know, they're going to be lawyers there from the DA's office who are going to cause problems potentially. Okay, somebody please mute yourself. We can hear your background noise right now.
Can you hear me?
John, oh, that's why. Okay, so John, you're going to ask your question?
Well, I just go by what information I learned from California. There was a judge that did something in March 2024, and then in December, a lot of Tier 3 people got letters in the mail to go to Tier 1. Some may have gone from 3 to 2, and that's what I was referring to in California.
Okay, so John, I think you're talking about what happened after we won the case about the attempted offenses. So and when the attempted offenses lawsuit, DOJ had to go back and re-tier people who were convicted of attempted offenses. So I think that's what you're talking about. And yes, some people went all the way from Tier 3 down to Tier 1, and so those people were indeed eligible. One of the things that bothers me, folks, quite frankly, is not enough people have, in fact, filed a petition for removal. I found this fact out last month in September when I went to the Sex Offender Management Board meeting, and they said they were expecting 30,000 petitions to be filed like in the first 12 months of the tiered that the tiered registry law went into effect. 30,000 petitions. But you know what? We're up to only about 12,500 now, and it's been 4 years. So in 4 years, only about 12,500 petitions have been filed instead of 30,000 in the first year. So I don't know why this is happening. I think maybe there are still people who don't know there's a tiered registry law. I think there's some people who are afraid to go back to court. I know one of my clients he had PTSD. I literally had to take him by the hand into the courthouse to let him know nothing bad was going to happen to him that day. The judge wasn't going to do anything. That his situation would not be made worse, even though he had to go to a hearing, because the worst thing that could happen is the judge kept him on the registry, which, by the way, didn't happen. The judge did, in fact, grant his petition that day. Okay. So that's one reason people do, in fact, hire attorneys to help them with that. Somebody's due to be off parole in the next few months. We'll be hiring Janice to help me with my removal. I'd be happy to help you. So that is something that's important to understand. If you are on parole or probation, you basically have to hit the pause button. You are not eligible to petition for removal if you're on parole or probation. And that in the federal system, that even means supervised release. Somebody else, Joyce, asked, any progress on moving the viewing of illegal photos from Tier 3 to Tier 1? I think the progress is the fact that we convinced the Sex Offender Management Board that that's the right thing to do. And so they, in fact, it's not just us and our annual lobby day, but also the Sex Offender Management Board now has, in fact, formally recommended to the state legislature that, in fact, people convicted of possessing child pornography do not belong on Tier 3, the highest tier, but in fact belong on Tier 1. And I mean, it's utter nonsense that this is what's happening right now, but it was a political compromise, right? It was a political compromise that I'll just name her by name, Lorena Gonzalez Fletcher, who is chair of the Appropriations Committee in the Assembly, and she got people moved from Tier 1 all the way up to Tier 3 based on a felony conviction for possession of child pornography. It makes no sense. Child pornography, I'm not condoning child pornography. I'm not possession of it, making of it, distributing it, no. But what I'm saying is it doesn't belong on the same level as somebody who's been convicted of a violent crime. Child pornography is a non-contact and non-violent offense. It's bad. Fortunately, I've never viewed it myself, but the fact is it's a bad thing to do. But I still think that for somebody who's charged with child pornography, they should get their hands slapped. We're talking about maybe just doing an infraction for the first offense. And then, if you, in fact, repeat that offense, then maybe then you should be convicted of a misdemeanor or put on Tier 1. So that's Janice's personal opinions right now. But I'm telling you, we did convince the Sex Offender Management Board to agree with us, and they have, in fact, done that. There's a formal, I forget if it's 4 or 5 pages now, recommendation to the legislature that certainly CP possession be moved from Tier 3, the highest tier, all the way down to Tier 1. Okay, somebody says, thank you, Janice and team, for all your hard work. You're very welcome. Somebody said he's shocked his counselor. Maybe you can tell us more about that. What about sting operation arrests? Okay, so in the context of the tiered registry law, there's good news there as well, because the Sex Offender Management Board has, in fact, recommended to the legislature that 288.2, 288.3, and 288.4 convictions, which include these sting operations, be moved from Tier 3 down to Tier 1 as well. So, I don't know about you, Ellie, but I just, so many years ago when I was in law school, we talked about entrapment, and so many of these sting operations seem like entrapment to me. What do you think?
Well, having been a public defender in LA County, I had cases where police officers would disguise themselves as a drug user and drug seller and try to sell a macadamia nut or a small piece of soap to somebody and then bust them for attempted possession of a controlled substance. It's absolutely a waste of time. The entrapment is, you know, they do it. They're still doing it. And I think it's a waste of time and resources. But that's my opinion. Yeah.
Well, and I agree with your opinion, Ellie. So thank you. So folks, I had a client who did this. He got in some chat room and everybody in the chat room was supposed to be at least 18, right? Well, anyway, he starts chatting with this female and lo and behold, she says, well, I'm not quite 18 yet. Maybe I'm 15 instead. Anyway, they made plans and they, you know, chatting back and forth. They made plans to meet each other at a bookstore. Okay. And he went to the bookstore. And of course, there was no such person, but the cops were there and nabbed him, right? And the thing is, and then they said, oh, okay, well, he was planning to go to the bookstore to have sex with this female because guess what? They found a condom in his wallet. That was their evidence that he went to this bookstore to have sex. And I'm like, are you kidding me? I mean, I heard so many single men say, yeah, I always keep one in my wallet in case I get lucky, you know, whatever the reason is. But he wasn't going to this bookstore to have sex with anybody. He was hoping to have somebody to talk to about books, for God's sakes, right? And so, fortunately, it was only a misdemeanor. But yeah, somebody says that happened to me. Said she was 17, going to 18 in a month. And many times these are adult women, by the way, or sometimes they're even men, right? Because you're doing it online. You don't know who's on the other end of the line, and they're portraying themselves as X, Y, or Z. So, folks, please, 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 please be careful. You know, there are people out there nowadays, and there's even vigilantes out there who in fact are trying to attract people, you know, through this. I just read about a terrible case and actually, what am I thinking? I remember about 6 months ago being in court, and it wasn't my case, but I was listening in, and it was some vigilante who basically had lured, you know, an otherwise innocent man to come meet with them, saying that they were an underage female. And then guess what? They got, they got arrested by the police. And it's not just stuff that's going online. It's also females in bars, right? And you're not supposed to be in a bar unless you're 21. That's what those bouncers are there for, right? To check your ID. So, and yet there are women who are in these bars who are not 21. Pardon me, they may not even be 18. So everybody gets a little tipsy to decide that they want to have sex. And then the next thing you know, you get busted because you just had sex with a minor. I'm sorry. It just makes me crazy. Ellie, you want to add to that?
No, Janice, but there was a question in the chat about somebody being on probation and the individual had a search condition. And so police officers went and searched the individual's room, but also forced the registrant's roommates, non-probationers, to stay downstairs and search their bedrooms without their consent or a warrant. And nothing was found. If I were the individuals who were not on probation and whose rooms were searched, I'd probably first file a complaint with the police agency. If there were damages, the individuals need to file an administrative claim within 6 months of the offense, and then I'd just go contact the ACLU.
Okay. Thank you, Ellie. Sorry, I just choked up there for a minute. you know what, folks? I have gone through the agenda that I have. I don't know if anybody else has any questions or topics you would like us to discuss. We're just about finished here with 2 hours worth of discussion. I'm so grateful that you are here today. I hope that we have been able to give you information that you can use in the future, whether it's joining an emotional support group meeting or when are you eligible to petition for removal. And remember, please, we're here because to support you. We're here to give you hope. We understand that you have a lot of challenges in your life, but we're here to help you and in whatever way that we can. Thank you very, very much. Roger and Ellie, you want to make any final remarks?
Just want to let people know that I recently read that Scott Weiner, who is in the state Senate and represents a district up in Northern California near San Francisco, may be running for Nancy Pelosi's seat.
Oh my gosh.
He,
Congress.
Yeah, he was very instrumental in the tiered registration legislation. And I'm not advocating for or against him, but I think it was interesting to read.
You know what? Thank you for sharing that, Ellie. I had not read it yet. Folks, Scott Weiner was the author of the tiered registry law. And we'd had some authors in the past who just couldn't and wouldn't take it across the finish line. But Scott Weiner, basically, he hung in there. It took us about 7 years to get the tiered registry law passed. And it's because of Scott Weiner that, in fact, it was passed. Roger, how about any closing remarks? Oh, wait, we got Emmy's got a EMI has a question.
I have a question.
Yes, please.
When can you start to apply to get off the registry after how long in your probation?
As long as you're not on parole or probation, it depends what your tier assignment is. So if you, in fact, you were assigned, if you're assigned to tier one, it just means 10 years of registration. And all that time you spend on probation does count toward the 10 years.
But can you apply to get off of it after the 10 years or?
Yes. Well, yeah. It depends on your tier assignment. Okay. So literally, if you're assigned to tier one, it's 10 years. If you're assigned to tier two, it's 20 years, and tier three, unfortunately, then you're not eligible. So
I think it's tier one.
Then that just means 10 years, and the timing starts from the time you're released from custody. So if you went to jail or to prison, the day after you're released, that's when the clock starts toward the 10 years if you're on tier one.
Okay,
does that answer your question?
Thank you. Yes.
You're welcome. And please contact either Ellie or I, and we can take you to the next step. Roger, you have something you'd like to say?
I appreciate everyone who's making regular donations. Really do. Makes a big difference. I just sent out the what you might have missed this week email. Please click on it as soon as you can. We want to test out the website to see, you know, if our new one can handle a bigger load. And you know, remember what you were told today about keeping safe. So much of it is just common sense. You know, we want you to stick around and not live life in fear. You know, I, as a tier three, I have to face this too. But I found that, you know, if I do the right thing, I can very rarely now is anyone approaching me. If anyone wanted to harm me, they'd see the security system. So you guys can still have a life. Don't hide in a rabbit hole. And most of all, come, you know, take part in what we're going to be sending out, you know, early next year, action alerts, where you can send emails, calls, and definitely come to Sacramento. We only get a tiny fraction of the registrants coming up with us. We'd love to see very large crowds come. So save up your money and appreciate all of you.
Thank you, Roger, for that. Take care, everybody. The next meeting is on November 15th. Hope to see you on November 15th. Take care. Bye-bye.